Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us. We are here every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are rebroadcast on a2zen.fm. You need to check that website for the listings and find out just exactly when. It's multiple times during the week, and we encourage you to check that out. And we archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. Lots of opportunities for you to check out our interviews as well as our guests. We link to their websites so that you can get the information that you need. And today is going to be, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, it's when I lived in Phoenix and I bicycled everywhere, I'll show you how this ties in with our guest here. I bicycled all over Phoenix and people thought I was absolutely bananas because of the traffic and the thoroughfares and all these kinds of things. But it's just what I did. I live in Santa Barbara now, and I have a hard time getting out on these narrow roads and competing with some of these cars. But I know that I put hundreds of miles on that bicycle, or multiple bicycles, because I did go through a few of them, and had some great adventures most of the time, and it was quite extraordinary. What if we took away the bicycle and spent those times walking everywhere? Or in this case, walking across... ostensibly walking across a ridge of a continent, especially a place in a foreign country, maybe that you've never been to before. The walk is one thing, but the experiences that you have along the way, that is another thing. And a million steps begins, of course, with the first, as the saying goes. And a million words begins with the first from our guest, Kurt Kuntz, who is the author of A Million Steps. He walked those 490 miles, basically across the Camino de Santiago. It's a pilgrimage route in Spain. And I want to welcome you to our program. This should be quite an interesting hour.
Richard, thank you so much for having me on the program. I'm delighted to be here.
I like your hairstyle.
Thank you so much.
It matches mine.
It's low maintenance. I like it.
Yes.
Very, very low maintenance.
I grab the old electric car polisher every once in a while and just buff it up real nice and looks real good. This whole business of people taking these kinds of treks, we hear of people for lots of different reasons. Other people and causes and diseases and so forth, trekking from shore to shore, Pacific to Atlantic here in the United States, or maybe from, the tip of South America north to as far north as you can go into Canada and so forth, or other countries, other continents. I know of a mountain climber, a blind mountain climber, who has climbed all 7 highest peaks on each of the 7 continents on the planet, which is quite extraordinary. You chose, first of all, you chose this particular route, this 490 miles that you walked along the, and I'm going to try to get this name correct again, the Camino de Santiago pilgrimage route in Spain. First of all, why did you choose that particular path?
There's a number of reasons. First off, people have been walking this particular trail for 1,300 years. A million people did it in the Middle Ages, and a million people have done it since that time. I knew there was something magic about it, and it was right up my alley as far as being a long journey. It put me in an environment where I was outside of my comfort zone in every aspect. I would be, as you mentioned, in a foreign country, a place where I didn't speak the language. The accommodations are quite different. I'm used to traveling in comfort and staying in pretty decent hotels, and over there you sleep in, they're called albergues, and they essentially are hostels for people on the walk, and you sleep in bunk beds with strangers. So with all of those things kind of being outside of my comfort zone, as I mentioned, I know from previous experience that those are the type of areas where I grow as a person. And this particular path, there's something about the history of it and the longevity and the energy of all the people that preceded me in the walk that I just felt one day I had to do it.
Well, I mean, I myself, in the 80s and throughout the 90s, I went to various intensives. I went through Life Spring. I went through a program called Omega Vector and Delta Vector, where I learned about myself and I grew. What was it about walking across the lands that you felt that that's how I'm going to grow? That's how I'm going to learn more about myself and be a better person?
Well, I have to back up a little bit, Richard. The way I look at it, I've taken, and I have to laugh about your Phoenix bicycling stories. I'm an avid bicycler, and I've done some very, very long journeys. In 2006, I actually did a solo 2,000-mile trek through Europe. And another year, I rode from Seattle down to San Diego. I went through a lot of Canada on a bicycle. And I look back at my life, and I think some of the nicest moments I've had have been on these type of journeys. So after having that experience, I decided I'm going to try something different. I've done all the cycling, and what's kind of a different, what's a trip and a journey that I can put together that will also involve exercise that I have a passion for? And that's how I came up with the Walk on the Camino. So when I got over there, and you asked the question of kind of how it changed or what lessons you get, the lessons that are taught from this walk are just unstoppable. The whole walk is almost a metaphor for life. And I really felt like I almost went through a whole life cycle in the month that I was over there walking. And it's just a joyous experience.
Well, I have to say that where I live in Santa Barbara, up on the hill above, when I have the opportunity, and I have to say that I do sometimes tend to miss the flatlands of Phoenix. Because I was not a goat in a previous life, apparently, because I don't seem to be able to circumnavigate rough terrain real well. And it's not even that I'm getting better at it. I don't even know if I'm getting better at it. All I know is that it has certainly changed things for me. Bicycling is not as much pressure on one's knees. We moved here. All of a sudden, I have knee problems. And I would often utter, I don't anymore, but I would often utter, my kingdom for flat land. And yet I used to love in Phoenix, there's a peak that I know as, it's called Squaw Peak. They've changed the name for various politically correct reasons, but it's always been known to me as Squaw Peak, but people would climb this thing all the time. They had the paths, and it was really kind of a nice walk. So I would bicycle up to the base and then walk the rest of the way, and a great view of the valley and so forth. When you chose this particular path, and you say this has been a path that's been walked for, 1,000, did you say?
1,300
years. There are other paths, I'm sure, elsewhere in the world that have been walked for even longer. Can you maybe hone it down a little bit more as to, was it because of specific people that traversed this particular path? What called out to you?
Well, this thing actually started out in the Middle Ages. This was a Christian pilgrimage, and it's believed that St. James, who was an apostle of Jesus, it's believed that his remains are buried below the cathedral. So in the Middle Ages, people walked from their front doors all throughout Europe to this particular cathedral in Santiago, seeking penance from St. James. As you fast forward to today, it's a much more modern pilgrim where some people are still very, very religious. A lot of people view this as a spiritual trek, and I fall more into that category. And other people simply want to do this as a bucket list item or some type of a physical challenge. I had a friend who did this walk in 2006, and when he told me he was going to do it, my first reaction was, are you nuts? I mean, why would you go and do this? And I just kind of put it in my back pocket, and that was the first time I heard about it. There's a movie with Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez called The Way, which is a very popular film that uses the Camino as a stage for an exceptional drama. I saw that movie in 2010, and in the theater, I said, I'm going to go and do that someday. So fast forward again a couple years, 2012 arrives, and I was kind of at the crossroads in my life with some issues with my girlfriend, and I knew we needed some kind of separation, and I thought that this trip would be a pretty good place to start that. So I bought a plane ticket, and 3 weeks later I was over there walking. So when I bought the ticket, I didn't even have a pack or shoes, or I didn't know much about the route. I just knew that if it sucked, I could always just ditch the pack and go to Paris. So I didn't see much downside in the whole trip. So anyway, in September of 2012, I found myself in a little city called Saint-Jean in France, which is the starting gate. And over the next month, I walked to Santiago.
Well, and I'm even as we speak, I'm flipping through and seeing some of these photographs that you have in your book. Again, the book is entitled A Million Steps. And, you know, I have to say that one of my dreams, my wife's and my dreams, is, believe it or not, to do similar to what Albert Brooks did in the movie Lost in America, get a motorhome, pack everything up in it, that all our worldly possessions, and sell everything off that we aren't going to keep, and just start trekking across the country. There's a certain element of that in this, in that you come across extraordinary people along the way. They're drawn to you. And I'm wondering about the people you came across as you trekked this month-long 490-mile path to a better a better Kurt. Or shall we say Kurt 2.0?
I like that. I like that very much. I think that's a very accurate statement. You know, I came across some of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life. And I think when you meet someone in your normal life, in your community or wherever it may be, it takes a while for those friendships to develop. You know, you meet somebody, you see them again, maybe have a cup of coffee, have a lunch, you meet part of their family, and they're kind of slow to progress. On the Camino, people come together from every corner of the globe. I mean, there's 197 countries in the world. I met people from 35 different countries. And when I say I met, I spent time walking with them, or I shared a meal with them, or something along those lines. And they are every color, every shape, every size, every age. The age variance was age 2 to 82, and obviously those were the extremes. But with the friendships, right when you start walking with somebody, you have so much in common in that we're all endeavoring on this brand new and fresh journey that the bonds just feel to be immediate. And with that, you really develop some nice friendships. And some of them last for days, some of them for weeks, some of them for minutes. There's one man I remember, his name was Harold, and he was the 82-year-old, and he was walking with his daughter from, she lived in San Francisco and he was from Houston. I walked with them for maybe 4 minutes, and I was so compelled by their story that I put a portion of it in the book.
Now, you obviously walked with a few people along the way. Did anybody join you for the duration or a majority of the path? Or was that something that you really wanted to keep this more of a solo sojourn?
Oh, I wanted to keep it a solo sojourn for sure. When I showed up there, I was alone. And I would say probably 80% of the people that I met along that trail did also show up alone. A natural thing happens. Some people meet people on day one and they walk the entire 500 miles to Santiago with that person or with that group. For me, that's not my style at all. I'm more independent, and I didn't want to really be tied down. And we all walk at a different pace. So I tended to spend most of my walking time alone. But in the evenings, when you get in these hostels, you're with all these other people that are also on the walk. And you have dinner with somebody, maybe the next morning you have coffee with them, and then they kind of weave in and out of your Camino. So there are certain people that you just kind of gravitate towards naturally. I also, I'm very tall, I'm 6'5", so I have long legs, and I didn't do this as a race, but I naturally walk faster than most people.
Mm-hmm.
So I tended to be always kind of marching into new people. In my last week, I slowed down predominantly because I was running out of runway. And in that last week, I kind of walked in with the same group of people for that last period. And that was very nice. I would say the depth of those relationships with the people were solidified because we spent more time together.
It's interesting. And, of course, you're originally from Boise, Idaho. I lived there. True story. I lived
there. You lived in Boise?
I lived there for a month.
Wow. You must have really liked it.
1980, I moved there with some buddies. because I wanted to try something. I figured if I don't go, I'm going to be kicking myself going, what if, what if, what if, what if? So I went ahead and I moved and I cut all ties to Phoenix. And I was there for a month, couldn't find work, couldn't get things started. So after the month, I got a call from a friend of mine, sort of ties into what I mentioned earlier, who said that if you'll come back, I will see to it that you get into the first level of LifeSpring, which was one of these intensives, like kind of like EST, but I never went through EST, so I don't have anything to compare it to otherwise. I said, yeah, okay, because, again, nothing was happening, and it took me a year to reestablish myself back in Phoenix. But when I was in Idaho, I was taken to some really extraordinary places. There's a peak, you probably know where it is and what it's called, that we drove up to the top of, where you could look 360 degrees in every direction, and you were above the tree line. The view was just unmatched. And I want to think there were several small towns we would pop into. I remember one evening we were out to dinner. I didn't want to go home. And of course, I was at that time, I wasn't driving. So I was subject to them telling me when we were going to come and go. And I said no. So they left me there. So I ended up walking the streets of Boise, Idaho. Talk about learning lessons about oneself. I got into a van with a guy. Which was very unnerving. And fortunately, he did turn the van around and took me back to, I guess, a motel. And I stayed there the night and they came, picked me up later and we moved on. But I remember how beautiful the country was. And I'm thinking, boy, this would, if I could just find work, this would be a great place to live. Yeah. And of course, with my cycling history in Phoenix, it was all pretty much flat. I mean, there are a few hills here and there. But for the most part, it's flat, and so it made it kind of nice. For your and I want to kind of backtrack a little bit because I know you're still cycling, but what are your thoughts, especially when you use them as a metaphor, shall we say, for your life and your growth and so forth? What about those hills that you come upon and you look at those things and you still traverse them? But something's got to go through your mind, especially the really steep ones. What am I doing? Why am I doing this?
There's a lot of that, and day one is by far the most difficult. Day one is so difficult that a lot of sensible people start on day two. Day one is you start in St. John, and you cross the Pyrenees. And that day, you climb 5,000 feet of elevation, and that's done over a 16-mile period. And I believe there's 10 miles in France, and the final six are in Spain. Then the rest of the walk is in Spain. Walking across these mountains, oh, it's an out-of-body experience. I'm walking up this hill, and I turn around, and I look, and I see it looks like a sea of cotton with mountain peaks sticking through it. I look to my left, there are thousands of sheep, and every one of those sheep has a bell. I look to my right, and there's wild horses and cows, and all those cows have bells. I then look up into the sky, and I see more clouds and more peaks ahead, and there's a bird there. It's called a griffin vulture, and they have an 8-foot wingspan, they're flying above my head. They look like pterodactyls, and they're coming through in groups. And it's day one. I can't believe I'm there. I'm starting the Camino. I'm walking across the Pyrenees Mountains. I mean, it was a moment. To get back to more of your question, it's very challenging. I mean, 5,000 feet of elevation in a day is rough. And I would say it's like anything. If you just start and you start to work at it, pretty soon, you know, it's just a day, and the day comes and goes, and you've made quite an accomplishment. So all of the hills along the way, which, again, that was the extreme. After that, I think the next 10 days, and let's say that's about 180 miles, the accrued ascent for the next 10 days is only 10,000 feet. Mm-hmm. So day one is a huge one, then it's kind of rolling hills after that. And they're all obstacles, but look, life is an obstacle, and you learn to overcome challenges, and that is a portion of what I saw as far as these hills. What was a little more challenging, surprisingly, is the middle of this trail, there's a 120-mile stretch called the Meseta, which is flat and barren. And many people say that's the Don Quixote portion of the trail, where you really you get deep inside your head because there are no distractions. And I found that to be a little more challenging than the hills.
Would you consider this trip in particular and maybe subsequent trips or previous, to be a form of meditation?
Oh, without question, it's a form of meditation. What was nice for me is the previous trips I've taken on bicycling, and for the most part, my life, I've kind of lived my life fast. In grade school, I wanted to be the first one done with the tests, and I got a job before everybody else, and I kind of plowed through college, and I got involved in a Fortune 500 company, and I climbed ahead rapidly, and I've always done things kind of with this type A, have to get there mentality. Cycling fits into that in that you can kind of go fast, and you move fast, and it's rapid. Going over there, and at the time I was 48 years old, it's a walk. You can't really walk fast, especially when you got 500 miles ahead of you. So it really slows you down, and it doesn't require much thought. When you're on a bike, you have to think about it. If you're mountain biking, you have rocks to deal with, or road bikes, cars, and this and that. Walking doesn't take much. You put one foot in front of the other, and hopefully you don't trip.
Yeah.
With that, you have a lot of time to really think about a lot of things. More importantly to me was the time spent not thinking, which gets into your concept of meditation. That is when the really cool stuff kind of bubbled up internally, and I had the kind of bigger moments.
Day and night walking, definitely different. Experience I had with some buddies, we drove out to this place in Arizona called Seven Springs, parked the car in the parking lot, and then we had two cars. And then the other guy, we had piled in his car, and we drove to the head of the spring, which was, I don't know how many miles it was. And we talked about it being a half-day hike. Little did I know that this was a literal half-day hike. We started out at 10 a.m. And the guy whose car we were in, he says, you know, I really need to get back to work. I can't leave work for this long. And we're sitting here going, okay, if you go, we're committed to walking to the end, getting back to this other guy's car. Well, the sun starts to go down. And fortunately, the moon was coming up. And we had, I think it was a quarter to a half moon. And this, to me, is extraordinary. I'd like for you to maybe address this as your experiences. When we walked in the moonlight along the stream heading towards our destination, the end of the trail and the car and everything, and everything going through our minds about my wife worrying and all of these different things. Are we going to get out of here? Are we going to be attacked by wild animals and all these things? We didn't trip once over anything. It was sure-footedness every step of the way. 2 weeks later, we went back to the exact same area in broad daylight, and we couldn't stop tripping over the rocks.
Isn't that something?
And I thought, wow. I mean, we were trusting. I mean, you want to talk about trusting your intuition, trusting the universe. And I was low vision at that time, legally blind. And we were walking by this, like I said, half moonlight. Tell me about, did you always stop at night? I mean, to me, that 120-mile flatland that you talk about, you know, the Don Quixote phase, seems to me like you just want to get through that as quickly as you could, not necessarily run, but if you could walk at night, would you walk at night?
Richard, I did not walk at night. I had the opposite. I'm quite an early riser, and on a lot of days, I was actually out walking at 6:30 in the morning, and it is pitch dark at that time.
Mm.
So you walk with your headlamp, and that is quite challenging. The trail is marked well, and it's pretty obvious where the trail goes. I mean, it's not like there's it doesn't have forks or things like that.
Right.
And there's little yellow arrows that mark this trail, and these yellow arrows are put out. There's no Department of Parks and Recreation that maintains these. These yellow arrows are maintained by the good people that live by the Camino.
Hmm.
These arrows are on bridges. They're carved into the roads. They're painted on buildings. They're everywhere. That's how you get from point A to the end of the road in Santiago, 500 miles following these little yellow arrows. I got lost on that trail two times. Both times when I was lost, I wasn't a half kilometer off the trail. I knew in my head and my heart I was in the wrong spot. And I've kind of taken that. I do a lot of speaking, and I end one of my speeches in talking about this, the idea that this sign guides you to where you need to go. I think there's a lot of signs in our existing life, wherever we're at, that tell us where to go. And the question is, are you willing to open your heart and head up to really see and feel them? And are you willing to have the faith that they'll get you where you need to go? So that was quite a moment for me. As far as walking in the dark, I finished in the afternoons, so I never had any of the evening part. But I have to tell you, that morning, you'd walk in the dark, you'd have your headlamp, and you kind of would struggle a little bit to find out where you're going. But when that sun came up, and it, you knew there was warmth around the horizon, and the morning light, I really like to take photographs. That the first crack of dawn on the horizon in the morning every day, it was just awesome.
Wow. Well, when we come back, I want to talk more about this and the things that you learned about self and about us in that regard, and we're going to do that. By the way, the website is kurtkuntz.com. That's Kurt, K-U-R-T-Z. Let me try that one again. I have the website. That's part of your last name. No. It is Kurt, K-U-R-T, and then K-O-O-T-N-Z.com.
No, wait, one more time.
All right, that's K-U-R-T-K-O-O-N-T-Z.com.
Perfect.
Okay, there we go. And you can find out, you can actually read more about this. You can see some additional photographs. I suppose that's probably the only thing that I wish these photographs were color in the book. Of course, I also know that drives up the cost of the price of the book as well. But nonetheless, you can see, I'm sure, many of them on the website. And what an extraordinary journey. We're going to talk more about it as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. Again, Kurt Kuntz is my guest, and it's A Million Steps. That's the title of the book, KurtKuntz.com. We encourage you to stay with us right here on Tell Me Your Story. It is hard to understand why people take on particular challenges, but I think one of the best elements of understanding is that it's their challenge, not yours. He's not asking you to go along with him, other than maybe euphemistically, metaphorically in this context, as we talk more with Kurt Kuntz, who has a book out. It's entitled A Million Steps. A Million Steps, and of course his website is kurtkuntz.com. That's KurtKuntz.com. And Kurt, I'm curious. I know that you address this in the book. I want you to share with us a little bit about one of, I'm sure that there were dozens of lessons that maybe not even aren't even in the book. What is, from your perspective, one of the most profound things that you gleaned while on this nearly 500-mile trek?
I have several of them. I would say that the most profound to me is the whole concept of living in the now. I read all the Eckhart Tolle books and the Wayne Dyers and the Tony Robbins and, you know, all of those deals. Everybody says the best place to be in life is to be in the now. I have endeavored to understand, what is that? I mean, we're all in the now, aren't we? We're here, we're talking, we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a little trouble really understanding what that is. The Camino, to me, made it crystal clear. Every single day, you have no idea what's in front of you. You don't know what the terrain is, what the weather is. You don't know what you're going to eat. You don't know where you're going to sleep, and you don't know who you're going to walk with. Nor do you know if your body is going to allow you to make the walk that day. So there's a lot of unknowns. And in that arena, I would say you're challenged on a daily basis. With that, you don't have any time or energy to think about yesterday or worry about tomorrow. And to me, that's what being in the now is. You then spend 30 or 40 days in that space, which is the time it takes to walk the 500 miles, and you really get a depth of understanding of what it is, and it's a nice, nice place to be. So when I come after coming home, the best realization as I have is, look, it's very natural for people to go into their past. I do it. It's impossible not to. But when I go into the past now, I say, what am I doing here? Am I here to, you know, cry about some bad thing that happened, a failed relationship, my father's death, or some traumatic event, or am I here to learn? And I really try to go in, learn, and get the hell out. The same with the future. You know, I have yet to meet a person who is not in 5 years going to be healthier, happier, wealthier, and skinnier. The trouble is, it's always a 5-year rolling window. And so if you're always kind of peering out on the horizon, you miss what's right below your feet. What is right below your feet is being in the now. So wherever I'm at, whatever I'm doing, I try to really be there. If I'm talking to somebody, I focus on the conversation. If I'm washing a dish, I try to really wash that dish. If I'm exercising, I try to feel my body and enjoy the sweat and go through it, not spend time thinking about what I'm going to do after exercising. And all of that came to me by walking this magic trail.
I noticed you also took a selfie of your feet.
I did. I have quite a few selfies
like
of my
that.
Feet.
I like that. That's very good. See, I'm walking. You can, you know, you don't, you know, I did this. I really did. That's why I'm taking pictures. But I just find it fascinating that you chose this path. I mean, are there plans from your perspective to circumnavigate other paths? I mean, of course, for example, are the Himalayas calling you?
I'm not sure where I would go. I'm going to do another one of these long spiritual walks, that's for sure. Domestically, there's the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail.
I was just going to ask you, how closely does the Camino Trail resemble the Appalachian Trail? Because I've heard stories about that trail, and it's quite remarkable in its own right.
I think that they really are night and day. And from my understanding of either Pacific Crest or the Appalachian Trail, you need to carry food, water, and a tent. And there's a lot of solitude. And now maybe it's become so popular that there's other people that are there.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of towns that you're really involved in. You're camping outside and this and that. This trail over here is dramatically different. There are 4 major cities along the Camino that have populations that are about, I'd say, 175 to 200,000 people. In between those cities are villages, and these villages are rarely more than 3 to 5 miles apart. So with that, there's an incredible infrastructure that allows you not to carry water, not to have to really worry about food, and you don't have to have a tent because you always have a place to stay in these albergues. So that is, I think, number one, the most dramatic difference. And the second portion for me, I like the idea of having all these people from other corners of the world to be walking with them. And I would personally not like to be on the Appalachian Trail, you know, walking along with a bunch of other folks from America and then come into a city and see a Texaco next to a McDonald's, next to a Walmart or something.
Mm-hmm.
And over there, it just doesn't exist. I mean, these little villages are so quaint, and people are still dependent upon agriculture for a living, and neighbors help each other out, and there's very little commerce. Most of the villages have a bar, which I'm telling you is the center of the universe. That's where you get food, water, cocktail, lunch, dinner, breakfast, whatever it may be. And then they may have one little store that's open. But, man, you know, from where you sit and from where I sit right now, you can probably go to a restaurant and have, you know, enchiladas or prime rib and a huckleberry milkshake and, you know, 13 types of brownies. Over there, it just doesn't exist like that. There is no fast food. There's not a lot of choice. And it's refreshing.
Well, and of course, even though there isn't a lot of choice, it doesn't matter to them that this is the way they live. I have to say that to a certain extent, certainly not to a great extent, but to a certain extent, our sojourns across Ireland when we were there twice, even though we were in a car, we weren't walking, we would come across the same kind of little villages. My wife was checking out the cemeteries, and at first I thought, this is kind of morbid. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me. These cemeteries are filled with the people that built these little towns and villages and hamlets. And without them, none of this would even exist.
Yeah.
So I began to see life, strangely enough, in a cemetery. So extraordinary, these villages.
You know, Richard, I have to interrupt you here for a minute. It was every one of these villages that I went into.
Yeah.
The cemetery was either the first thing that greeted you,
yeah,
or it was the departing moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of the first thing you saw coming to town or the final thing you saw going out. And like you, I walk through quite a few of them, and it is humbling. You go through and you read some of the names. Some of them have pictures. Some of them are very ornate graves. Some of them very modest. And they're the families that have been there, for so many years.
Yeah.
And the history of the area is just overwhelming.
Well, you've already told us, too, that the people that you know back here in the States, your family, your friends, and so forth, obviously, kind of looked at you askance going, yeah, you, I've got a therapist you need to see. But I have a feeling, too, that after your return, a lot of that, if it wasn't there, they were more impressed with what you came back, shall we say, as, or what you had found as a result of this journey. And it feels a little bit like, and I may be wrong about this, that not everybody has the wherewithal to just take off for a month and go do something like this.
That's very correct. And again, I do a lot of public speaking, and that is one of the main questions. People say, well, gosh, you know, you're lucky, you have the time, you have the energy, you have there maybe some resources, whatever it is, that allows you to do that. And I'm telling you, I am. I'm very blessed and I'm very fortunate, and I do take advantage of these type of situations. I would say this, though. To me, a Camino is, again, about getting outside of your comfort zone and doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take Camino every single day. If you want to start, I'd recommend that you drive home from work a different route than you did yesterday. I'd recommend that your next vacation be to a location you've never been to. You can go to a bookstore this afternoon, buy a cookbook, and make what's on page 49. That, to me, is what it's all about. It's just don't do the same thing that you did yesterday. So if you can't fly across the ocean, which is very understandable, and you don't want to walk 500 miles, which is very, very much more understandable, don't do it. But I'm telling you, to lead a better life, stop doing the same thing over and over and over, because pretty soon you're going to be old and you're going to look in the rear of your mirror and go, that was it? Wow.
And at the age of 20, that was the reason I moved to Idaho.
I like it.
Because, that was, and I'll be honest with you, that was the main argument that I would have for people who were trying to dissuade me. I had the opportunity, and I would tell them, if I don't go, I'm going to be what-ifing the rest of my life.
There's now, no question about it.
Yeah. And it turned out, obviously, I was there for a month. I met some really nice people, and it was a lot of fun and all of those kinds of things. And sadly, I haven't heard from this friend of mine since. I don't know what happened to him. I hope he's doing well. But I have to say, too, I would agree with you as far as this whole business of creating your own Camino. And I traverse 2,200 feet every day. However, I do it in a car. I do it in a car, and it only takes about 7 minutes. But and so there's really no real opportunity from the base of the hill to the summit where we live for me to take a different route. But certainly to get to the base, I can certainly take different paths to get there as well. But I have to say, I really enjoy walking. I can walk from – I obviously couldn't do this back in Phoenix, but here in Santa Barbara, I can walk from the radio station to the beach in 20 minutes.
Nice.
And then I can walk along the beach if I want. And I have to tell you that with the knee problems that I've had over the last 3 years, had surgery a year ago, when that was done and everything was healed and doing, I was out there and I was so aching to get back out and walking, even when my knee now, because I still have these issues, is a little swollen, I still want to just get out there and walk. I don't care if it really hurts. I just want to be out there and under my own locomotion. There's something about that that you don't really get from a bicycle, you don't get from a car, that you only get when you put one foot in front of the other to the point where you create, in your case, a million steps. Do you feel the same way?
Oh, very much so. This will probably surprise you. I'm not a walker at all. The longest hike of my life was day one on the Camino, which was 16 miles over the Pyrenees. I'd never walked 16 miles one day in my life ever. Now, I've cycled in immaculate distances, so physically I wasn't as worried about it. But as far as actually doing the walking, it's something I haven't done. And there's something, again, where it's such a mindless exercise. And it is also exercise. I thought, well, it's a long ways to walk, mm-hmm. but physically it's not going to be that challenging. And, I mean, on the trail, I lost 18 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't really, I mean, when I left town, I weighed 215. I came back 197 and a little too thin. And I have put about 10 of those back on, which is a good thing. But I just never really thought of walking as being that challenging. And it is, yeah. especially when you, put a lot of miles on each day.
Well, when I do walk that 20-minute walk, it's basically about 13 blocks. I don't know how that calculates in miles, but especially if I walk down and then walk back up again and then whatever I do in between, usually I walk down there and I'm doing fine and I'm not really huffing and puffing. But by the time I get back, not only am I can feel my heart, it's really pounding, but I can feel the perspiration, which I didn't feel down at the beach. You know, it's like, okay, I really got a good workout, and I'm in my I'll say early 50s. I'll be 54 this year, and it's one of those aspects that is talked about on this program by many of my guests who say, and you did this, and you've done it more than once, who say the best way for you to recenter yourself, to get your focus back. Yes, meditation's a good thing, and this, as you've described, is a form of meditation, is to reconnect with nature. And when you put one foot in front of the other, you're putting one foot down, on the ground. And okay, there may be concrete there may be pavement and what have you. Find a park, whatever. But that's one of the things that they say constantly. Reconnect with nature, and I would believe that you are just as strong an advocate as they are.
Oh, very much so. I love your analogy. You're connected to Mother Earth with your foot all the time, and on top of that, with the slowness of walking, your eyes are open to slowly taking in the landscape.
Yeah.
And whether it's a drop of morning dew or a sunrise or a sunset or watching the leaves blow on a tree or the clouds, whatever it may be, it's your entertainment. You don't have iPods and stuff like that. Your entertainment is nature.
Yeah.
And then the people that come into your life, they're obviously natural too. And it's just a real calming effect. And this idea of walking, I am a kind of a lunatic for physical exercise. And I've often wondered, what am I going to do later on in life? I mean, I can't ride a mountain bike when I'm 70. It's probably not very wise. I know I can. Just suffering the consequences of the crash are a little bit hairier then.
I hear you.
And I wonder, what will I do? And I'm telling you, this walking, I know I've got a big future in that.
Yeah. And me both. I have a bicycle in the closet, and I have to pull it out and air up the tires every time I want to go for a spin. But I get real nervous, even though I have a side view mirror. I get real nervous getting out on these roads. Phoenix would be fine because they're wider. They're designed for bigger cars. But Santa Barbara is not designed for these big SUVs. And you really have to be careful. Whereas you get out and you start walking, you have more control. You can turn and do this and that and the other thing. It's just a wonderful thing. And then when you get down, in my case, I get down to the beach, I can take my shoes and socks off and start walking in the sand down in the surf for that matter.
I like it.
I mean, it's just, as a matter of fact, I have to tell you that I remember this so vividly, almost as if it was yesterday. When we first moved here back in 2006, I'd gotten a job and, As the job went on, I realized, what the heck am I doing this job for? And of course, it was nothing more than a stepping stone, and I had to keep that in mind. But I remember after getting the job, getting my first paycheck from this job, it was almost as if it was the first job I'd ever had as a kid. And so I went down to the beach, and I parked the car, and I got out and took my shoes and socks off, and I went up to my knees or higher in the surf, just like, oh my gosh, I have made it, kind of thing. But I did it there.
as opposed to, say, going to a bar and knocking back a few for liberty and life and and all those other things. I just have to say that it's just been extraordinary. And so I would encourage anybody and everybody, if you can, you know, it doesn't have to be a long trip, 500 miles or a million steps. just take a few. Just
The get block. Outside and walk. It's a wonderful therapeutic thing to do, and it's just never. It's something you'll never regret.
Oh, absolutely not. When you are on these types of travels, especially even in the case of traveling to various speaking engagements and meeting all these different people who have read your books and followed your sojourn and so forth. When you're in this mode, if you will, especially in that context of traveling to various places and sharing your story, how do you stay focused? They want to hear about the past, stuff that's already happened. How are you able to bring that around into what you spoke about earlier as the now?
Well, that's a very good question, and I would it's a very good one. When I go and do these speaking events, historically, from my business background, I would have been more focused on, okay, where's the event? What's the city? How do I get there? How much am I going to get paid? How much time is it going to take? And it would really be a little more mechanical along those lines. I don't look at these things like that at all. I look at it as if I have found my purpose, and my purpose is to go and tell people about this walk and hopefully inspire them by the lessons that I learned and maybe allow them to take a different viewpoint on their life. In going to these things, I enjoy every moment of it. I enjoy getting on the airplane and talking to the stranger next to me. I enjoy checking in the hotel. I enjoy checking out the new city that I may be at. I enjoy going to the event. I enjoy when the event is over. And I don't make it the classic deal of the destination of get there, paycheck, get home. I just soak the whole thing up. I was last about, let me see, on January 18th, which was my 50th birthday, I was in San Diego on vacation, and I have a friend down there who works in the library system. He asked me to speak at two libraries, and I had just an incredible time at these libraries, and these serendipitous things happen to me that are just, they're almost too far out to even be possible. Prior to going down there, I got an email from a woman who was 75 years old, and she said, I'm reading your book. I love it. It gave me the opportunity to feel like I had walked the trail. And she felt she was too old to do it, which I disagree with, but she thanked me for that. She said, if you're ever in Southern California and you're speaking, let me know, and I'd like to come hear you. I responded back to her within minutes and said, my gosh, you're not going to believe this, but I'm going to be in Del Mar on Saturday, and if that's close to where you live, that'd be great. She goes, I live 4 miles away. She then responded to me and said, I got on your website, and I noticed that you're also speaking in Boise. My sister lives there. She's going to come and hear you tonight. Now, what are the chances of that? I would say zero. That, to me, is a magic moment of an event like that. And let me fast forward to the next library I went to. I went in there, and there's a woman that works there who somebody had told me ahead of time that she had walked the Camino. Her name was Connie, and we started talking about it. I said, well, when did you go? She said, I went in 2012. I said, when did you start? She said, I started in September. And she said, the day before I started, there was a really big rainstorm, so I delayed, and I started to walk the next day. And I said, please don't tell me that you started on the 12th of September. And she said, yes, I did. And, I mean, come on, Richard. There's 6 billion people on the planet. I mean, I walk into a library in San Diego, and I meet a woman who I actually walked across the Pyrenees with. I mean, that's just too much. And those things, I'm telling you, they happen to me a couple times a week. It's just, and I've become to expect them. And it reinforces to me the spirituality and the concept that we are all connected, and it's a small world and those type things. So I don't know if I answered it. I kind of gave you a long answer there, but I enjoy every portion of every moment of every day, no matter what I'm doing.
And I'll throw in a new pronunciation for the word that we would normally use to describe those kinds of events. as coincidences. I don't believe in coincidences. These events, people, and different things of this nature come together for a reason, whether we know what it is or whether we figure it out or not. So that's why I've taken to referring to them as coincidences.
Yeah, it's perfect. All of these people that are coming into my life now, you and me today,
yeah.
and Connie from last week, and all these new people that come into my life, I take that right back to the Camino. Every day, strangers came into my life. And I started to notice, again, I called them shadows, the people that seem to come in quite often. And I would finally let my guard down and introduce myself and meet him and talk to him and learn about them. And I believe that people come into your life for a reason. They share a gift with you, or you share your gift with them, and kind of after it's been rendered, they go. And when they go, it allows them to share their gift with someone else and allows space in your head and heart to let other people come in.
Yeah.
So with that, I took a deeper side of kind of the whole concept of letting go of relationships. Ultimately, it's a little bit morbid here, but 100% of mortal relationships end. And in accepting that, I look at my relationships that have ended and likely will end and say, I'm not going to be sad about them. I'm going to instead focus on how much that person meant and all the good, great times we had together instead of focusing on, oh, gosh darn, it's over. Because every time one closes down, a new door opens. And I don't care if that's a loving relationship, a losing a family member, a business relationship, whatever it may be. Every time a door closes, another opens.
Absolutely. Oh, I couldn't agree more. I've been fortunate and shared this many times on the program that I feel as though I've been in the right place at the right time throughout my entire life, especially in terms of the career. My father told me years ago, said a lot of great things, and this is one of them, that says, pick a job that you love to do, because I didn't and I got stuck. Now, he was fortunate enough that he was able to go back to college and in his 30s and early 40s to take computer programming courses, where he would bring home the fanfold paper and the punch cards, boxes and boxes of punch cards. Oh, we had a lot of drawing paper around the house for several years. But that was in the 70s. And I don't even think I did it consciously. Because I can't think of a conscious decision that I made to get into this business other than to take a job. Someone said, oh, yeah, there's this job over at this station. Maybe check it out. And I was working for the audiovisual department at the local community college in Phoenix. And one thing led to another, and bing, bang, boom, and now I'm here. So I think that when we start to, like you talk about this, you stay in that, in the now moment, you stay focused and centered on here. I have to say that one of my greatest metaphors for that is in front of me as we are speaking, as we record an interview. And I know you've seen software that's recorded interviews, and you see a line that moves across the screen. And at that line on the left side, you see the voice is created into a digital image, a wave. On the right side of the line, there's nothing. It's blank because there's nothing there yet. But the now moment is that vertical line. At the instant that the words are spoken, and as soon as you can see them, it's not the now anymore. And I remember thinking about that going, wow, that's pretty neat.
It's a nice analogy.
I need to focus on the line, so to speak, and not what comes after it, what I might think might be coming or what's already been said, but what's, boom, right there. And when you're walking, that it sounds to me like when you're walking, boom, that's where you are.
Oh, you're there. There's no question about it.
What about some of the challenges of the physical body in particular? Because you and I both know that no matter how much we love walking, that there comes a point when it's like, I have got to stop. I got to rest. My feet are killing me. As much fun as we love walking, there comes a point where I got to sit down.
It happens. It happens every day. And at the beginning of the trail, one of the things that happens to a lot of people, and happened to me also, is you go through some blisters. And there's not a spot underneath the shoelace that is not susceptible to blisters.
Yeah.
Most people are used to getting one on the back of your heel. I'm telling you, they grow between the toes. You can get them on the base of your feet, on the top of your feet, on the sides of your feet. And blisters are an issue. So that's a physical challenge. And I don't care how prepared you are. You walk 500 miles, your body gets a little upset with you. Your feet hurt, and your tendons hurt, and your knees hurt, and especially in that first one of the veterans told me, I love this. They told me the first portion of the trip is for the body, and it's very accurate because you go over these hills and you build stamina, you build muscle, you go through some pains. But after that first third, your body's in pretty good shape, and it does accommodate, and it understands and says, okay, now I know what we're doing. So the physical aspect pretty much disappears at that time as far as the really challenging stuff. You then get to that middle flat portion, and again, the veterans tell me that part is for the mind. And with nothing to distract you, again, very accurate. So you go through, 120 miles of walking, which is, 5 to 8 days, depending on your speed, in that arena. The final portion of this, it's very much like a Washington State or Oregon area, kind of a rainforest, very rich and lush and big mountains and rivers and streams and lots of green foliage. You realize then there's an end. When you get to Santiago, it's over. And I think like a little bit of the whole lifeline analogy, as you move closer to the end, and you have a strong body and a clear mind, that's when your soul is filled up. You're just like a sponge taking in every moment. Maybe it's a conversation, maybe it's a sunrise, whatever it may be. It really is. There's three stages of this trip, the first for the body, the middle for the mind, and the final for the soul. And boy, it very, very accurate.
Well, it's almost like there's a draw to want to do something like this. To again, as we talked earlier, creating your own Camino, and jumping on the trail and just start going. I used to feel this way, especially about group intensives. 4 or 5 day kinds of things, like I talked about earlier in the program. And I thought, it sure would be nice to be able to just go out and learn about myself without a bunch of other people being around, and this is that opportunity.
Oh, you learn so much about yourself, and this is a little bit of a harsh toke, if you will, here. A lot of people say the time, I could never get the time, I could never do it. I believe that people do what they want to do, and if you really want to do something badly enough, you'll make the time to do it. This trip, I was out of my home for 35 days. I think the average person, the average person is expected to live to be 80 years old now. 30 days in the life of 80 years is less than 1/10 of 1% of your time alive on this earth. I would say a walk like this has the potential to change your outlook on the rest of your life. So instead of just saying categorically, I don't have time, I'd recommend people try to make the time, because it's an insignificant amount and it will likely change your life.
I think that's one of the things that we all have to get over, is that whole issue of time, thinking there's not enough. My wife and I are presently working on honing down all of our worldly possessions, for example. I went through, and I kid you not, Kurt, I kid you not, I went through a foot and a half tall stack of papers in one Saturday, sifting through, throwing into a bin that'll go into a shredder. I'm going to say 95% of those papers, which cleared off a bookcase shelf for me to put some of the books like yours on there. And I thought, why was I keeping all this this garbage? And that's what it is.
Yeah, it sure is.
And I can't burn it in the fireplace. It's not good to burn these kinds of things in there. So I can grind them up, in a shredder. But
What I find is that even those kinds of events where we went through everything that was under the house that we had stored from when we moved in 2006, and there were boxes we hadn't opened since we moved there in 2006.
Yeah.
And we emptied every single one. And it's like, I can't believe, we could actually, if we were making a place for a midget to stay, we could put in beds for two or three or four, you know, short people.
Yeah.
You know, that's how much room we opened up. And those kinds of activities, including the getting out and walking and moving forward and the meditation in that regard, that's a form of cleaning out too. Clearing the mind and I'm trying to think of the phraseology here, but it's what you went through as you went through, especially the last third of your journey in terms of and I think about that 120-mile flatland that you went through. You know, to me, that's like, wow, that I'm sure that you had mountain peaks around that you could see off into the distance, that kind of thing. It wasn't like you were out in the middle of I think about the ocean. I was on a cruise once, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know how scary it would be to be just me out in the middle of this water, floating, and nothing around? You're out in the middle of, out in the middle of nowhere.
I can kind of see a bit of the analogy there, and it's a very good one. You, in this, when you're over there in that flat portion, you're connected to the ground, so you have the ground below your feet,
right.
But there's not a lot to distract you.
Yeah.
What happened to me through there was a little bit strange, but the weather distracted me. I had gale force winds the entire time I was in that area.
Oh, my gosh.
And I've never, and it's a classic story. You can either walk along and go, oh, this sucks, the wind's blowing, and oh, this is bad, and get all uptight about it, or you can say, the wind's going to blow whether I care about it or not. So just accept it and go with it. And I started to appreciate it. I thought, well, if the wind's not blowing, it would probably be hot. And if it was, you know, if it was raining, you'd probably, you know, it's always going to be something.
Yeah.
So just go with it. And then I started to, again, to appreciate it. I started to go, wow, well, when I would rarely see a tree, to watch the way that it made the leaves move and to watch the clouds and how the wind just gyrated them and moved them around. And I never really thought of weather distracting me, but it did. And I didn't need the distraction. It was a nice portion of the trail, but
yeah.
It was an interesting part.
Now, some people might think that the easiest part of this kind of a trek would be those portions of the path that were downhill.
Wrong.
And tell me why.
Yeah, it just, I mean, your body is, it is as difficult to walk downhill as it is to walk uphill.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. And I found up front, I had, my knees were in pretty good shape, and going uphill I had no problem, but going downhill in the first couple of days, I started to have some knee issues.
Mm.
And one day I turned around and I was using the hill to stretch, and for some crazy reason, I started walking backwards. And I took a couple steps downhill, again, backwards, and I found it's almost like walking uphill. It took all the pressure off my knees.
Oh, wow.
So I found a few, and then, again, I take that same metaphor there of just trying to do something different. And I didn't do it on everyone, but on some pretty steep downhills, I walked backwards. I, again, most likely look like a moron, but who cares?
Well,
it felt great on my knees, and it solved a problem.
Before we wrap up our interview here, a few questions left on my list here. Number one, who is Kurt Kuntz?
Well, I was born and raised in the big city of Boise, Idaho here. I went to college at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington. I immediately came back and went to work for a Fortune 500 company called Micron Technology. And I worked there for a number of years in sales, and at a very young age, and the age was 36 years old, I decided to just pull the plug. I said, I'm just going to retire. And I decided that I would really, I didn't leave with stacks of gold at all, but I came up with the idea, what's more important in my life, time or money? And I had some, a few small investments that allowed me to do that. And the amount of money I live on, I'm telling you, most people would blush. It's just not very much. And if you don't need things, and instead you need experiences, you'll find you don't need very much money. So over the past, since from 36, I'm now 50. Over the past 14 years, I really have changed my life. I've slowed down. I do a lot of physical exercise. I do a lot of volunteer work. I try to help people as much as I can, and I love to take these journeys. And the journey I'm on now, when I left on this trip, I left without any expectations whatsoever. I just thought I was going to go on a cool walk. Halfway through the trip, I was so overwhelmed by what was happening to me, I got the idea, I'm going to try to write a book. So when I came home, I spent the next 7 months on a brand new journey of writing the book. Well, about halfway through that, I thought, well, I better find somebody who wants to buy this thing. How am I going to do that? So that opened up another journey of promoting it and speaking and doing all these things. And I would say that the way my life has changed is instead of being focused on that end zone, I really, really have learned that, and it's an old story, but it is so much more about the journey than the destination. And I'm not sure where this goes. I mean, the book's doing pretty well, but it's going to take me where it needs to go. If it's meant to be well-read, it will be. If my speaking is meant to be a big deal, I'll be invited to a lot of different places. But I'm not going to really worry about, am I going to make the money on it? Am I going to be a big deal? It's just going to happen. Wherever it's meant to go, it will go to.
Yeah. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I just really want to inspire people. I want to inspire people, as I think I've said six times here, stop doing exactly what you did yesterday. I read a book a while ago and it knocked my socks off. It said, if you want to know what's going to happen in your life in the next 30 days, fire the fortune teller, forget the Swami, you don't need him. All you need to do is take an inventory of what happened the previous 30 days, because it's going to repeat over and over and over. Mm. And if you don't consciously get out of those ruts and realize that that you're becoming a bit dull, you'll just become more dull. So I say, stop doing what you did yesterday, jump off the ledge, dive off the high dive and worry about the water halfway down. And you'll find that 99.9% of the time, things work out just fine.
Oh, yeah. Without going into the long story, our journey to Santa Barbara was based upon the feeling that we were on a precipice. And my wife was very concerned. And to that, I said to her, having interviewed so many folks such as yourself, I said, well, the message is very clear. We have to jump and trust.
You got it.
Just jump and trust.
Go for it.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Incredibly powerful. And if you can, I'm probably going to go off on a little tangent here, but another big thing that I learned over there, I didn't worry about anything. And I'm a worrier, so mm-hmm. This was a foreign concept to me. But I just found that things really worked out. And then I found the more I let go of worry, the better they worked out. Mm-hmm. So in coming home, I sat down one day, and I made a list of all the things I worry about. I came up with 13. I then immediately crossed 8 of those things off the list, saying, why am I going to worry about these? They're completely beyond my control. So I end up with this tiny, tiny little list of things to worry about. I then look at the other side of the ledger of gratitude. What's going right? What's working? What's good? That list is infinite. You know, you have air in your lungs, you have food, you have shelter, you have friends, you have family, you have shoes, and if you're not thankful for your shoe, be thankful you have a foot to put it on. it goes on forever.
Yeah.
So there's these five little pissant things to worry about, and there's all these things to be grateful for. I choose gratitude. And that is another beautiful thing that this walk brought to me. And I don't understand. I'm still mystified that how walking for 30-plus days in a foreign country, all these things became so clear to me. And they really did. And I don't know, everybody that walks that Camino, everybody certainly gets a different take on it. Something happens, you know, my experience was unique, and the guy next to me, his experience was unique, and that's the nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand how such a life-changing event can occur in so many facets of my life with just a walk, a 35-day timeout. And, boy, it was mystifying.
Well, I know people talk about miracles and those kinds of things and these different kinds of events that happen in our lives. And I've given up the whole process of saying, well, let's see, if this hadn't happened, if I could get rid of this part and that part and the other part, and then I realize, and I wouldn't be the person I am today.
Exactly.
So you embrace the dark and the light. You embrace both the things that you worry about as well as you're grateful for the things that you have. And it just makes, to me, again, that is another form of clearing out a lot of the old stuff. It really is.
I really tried to write the book in a manner that people can feel like they were not only in my shoes, but my head and my heart.
There you go.
And they could get an understanding of what a person goes through on a walk like this. And so hopefully the people that read the book will really get a feeling of what a journey like this is like.
I hope they will. I certainly do. And I hope that they will also go to your website. KurtKuntz.com is the website. The book, A Million Steps. Kurt, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us here today. And look forward to having you back again in the near future. As a matter of fact, if you ever find your feet walking in this general direction, please look us up here in Santa Barbara. We'd love to have you in studio.
Oh, that sounds great. I would love to. And thank you so much for the time. I can't believe that it's flown by this quickly.
Absolutely. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.